You're listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avasant's on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer in residence. Barely 1 year into the UK's major defence modernisation plan, the MOD must once again revisit its military priorities. The result can be significant program cuts to the armed forces. Largely driven by Brexit budget shortfalls, the latest review is caught between a requirement to find £20 billion in savings and the MOD's recent campaigning to ramp up defense spending. The likely outcome is a further round of cutbacks focused on the Royal Navy and Army, with implications such as the potential end of amphibious operations for the nation's security posture in the decades to come. To talk about this, we're joined by Ben Goodlad, UK Analysis Manager in Avasant's London office. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's take a high-level look at where things stand with the UK. The 2015 Strategic Defence and Security Review laid out a path forward, but now it looks like that's in question.
Part of the main thing with the 2015 SDSR was that it had efficiency savings already built in. So it was already going to be under pressure financially in order to make the equivalent plan work. Then Brexit happened and the value of the pound fell, and the cost of any US procurement, particularly P-8s from Boeing and Apache helicopters, for example, has risen quite significantly. It's also pushed the price of weapons such as Trident missiles up. So basically the value of the budget isn't what it was. Therefore, what we're seeing is there's a need to actually reevaluate what can be spent. And the UK is fairly committed to its procurement programme. It's emphasising that it wants to procure its new equipment. However, that's going to mean cuts to existing capability in order to actually free up funds to make this happen.
When we look at the top line numbers involved in the budget priorities for the current MOD plans under SDSR, does that tell the whole story, or do we need to look service by service to really understand the priorities for the UK's defence posture in the years to come?
I think we need to look service by service, because what's important when you look at the budget, it also includes equipment support. It's not broken out with O&M and procurement, for example. It includes the support budget. So if you look at the Navy, for example, 65% of the roughly £29 billion that they plan to spend in the next 10 years is actually support costs as opposed to new procurement. Whereas the Army, it's a much higher procurement figure compared to support. So the decisions that are going to be made do vary based on the types of spending we're going to see. And I really think that support money is where savings are going to be made in order to enable new equipment to be procured, and for the UK government to show that they are procuring new equipment and really showcase the equipment they're bringing on board at the expense of new capability coming through. So we're going to see equipment cut at the expense of new equipment.
Well, let's look at this then service by service. So the Royal Navy, which is coming off of a very recent national shipbuilding strategy, has laid out some clear priorities around the Type 26 frigate, support ships, a lighter frigate, and there's also carriers in production as well. So who becomes the bill payer in their priorities?
Let's start with the aircraft carriers. The UK government inherited the carrier programme, and in the 2010 SDSR, they took the decision that they needed to continue with the carrier programme because it was actually too expensive to cancel the programme, and it was stuck with the decisions of the previous government. This meant they had to take quite tough decisions, and they opted to make savings at the time. That's why we see the withdrawal of the UK's carrier capability in the form of ARC Royal and Illustrious taking out of service at a time when the UK had no essentially carrier capability at all. Fast forward to 2015, we're in a similar position where the UK has ship in the pipeline, but it's had to accept that it cannot afford all the ships it wants to do. So that's where we see the Type 26 and the Type 31. In an ideal world, the UK could procure 13 Type 26 frigates and had a frigate fleet based on the Type 26. However, the acceptance is that that is completely unaffordable. So that's where the Type 31 comes in, with a price out, a very aggressive pricing of £250 million per ship, with the aim both to make that affordable for the UK and then potentially exportable as well. It's quite an aggressive cost-saving measure, but it should mean the UK is able to fund essentially 13 frigates with five Type 31, plus then the seven Type 26 that are coming through. So that should ensure that in the future, the UK has enough frigates for its job. But how to pay for that, they may have to make decisions in the short term, removing ships from service in order to make savings in that equipment support bill, which, as I said, is approximately 65% of the equipment plan. So that's where we're going to see savings.
That's an approach that's been used in the past. Has it been effective?
I think it's been a risk. I think in terms of balancing budget, it's been effective. When the Conservative and Lib Dem coalition government came in 2010, they took the decision that they would balance the budget. There was a black hole of the defence budget, and the decision was taken that needed to be sorted out. That's where we saw the decision to remove ships from service and multiple others. That did balance the budget in the short term, and they took that risk of not having the carrier capabilities. This is probably something that they got away with. They were still able to contribute to operation against Islamic State by using aircraft from RAF Akateri in Cyprus. And it didn't have a huge impact on what the UK could do strategically. But it was a gamble. And the risk is the UK has decided that gamble is worth taking in order to save money in the short to medium term. So I can very much see those gambles being taken again in order to make sure that in the long term they have the equipment they want.
Any given cut or reduction often has second, third order effects. You've talked about how the Navy's landing platform docks could potentially be taken out of service, which would be a profound moment for the Royal Marines.
Yes, the UK's amphibious capability currently relies on two landing craft with HMS Albion and HMS Bulwark. For the last decade, they've essentially been operating one, with one ship laid up and one ship in service. So they've already made significant cuts there. The idea of actually removing both from service means that the UK essentially won't have the ability to land troops ashore. They do have the Bay-class auxiliary troop carriers, but these don't actually have a large capability to actually launch a full-scale operation. At most, it would take two Bay-class ships to launch a single company of more Marines. So they would be used for small-scale operations. The implications for the Marines in this case is that if they didn't have a large-scale amphibious force, decisions would have to be made from how Royal Marines were then used. We could see the Royal Marines used as a helicopter assault force, using helicopters launched from HMS Queen Elizabeth or HMS Prince of Wales, the UK's two new carriers, and that would enable the UK to continue having an assault capability offshore. They've done this before, for example in 2003 when the Royal Marines stormed the Al-Faw Peninsula in Iraq using helicopter assault capability from HMS Ocean. However, this does come with risks in the sense that would the UK be willing to risk a high value asset such as HMS Prince of Wales so close into shore that it then comes under threat from a long range anti-ship missiles, for example. So that does have risk. But for the Royal Marines itself, they're then struggling to justify their role as an amphibious fighting force. I think there will always be Royal Marines for roles such as fleet protection and going back to their more traditional roles of being on ship. However, they've always had the ability to conduct amphibious landings. It's something they've conducted throughout the 300-year history. So there will be very strong principal noises being made at the idea of actually cutting this ability away from them.
Shifting services to the Army, they're in the middle of a major reorganization around their main fighting force, the 3rd Division. How does a mini SDSR or whatever comes out of this current phase impact that plan in terms of procurement, in terms of priorities?
Any savings made to the Army does have this potential to have quite a large impact on that force 2025. The force that was created has already been formulated in the idea that we don't have unlimited resources. It's already identified the fact that there would only be two armoured brigades and then two strike brigades using a medium force. And on paper, this was designed to be a mixed capability and flexible force, but the reality is this is an acceptance that we cannot field four full brigades, including heavy armour such as Challenger 2 and Warrior. So if you were to reduce those programmes further in need for cuts, this would reduce the UK's ability to conduct manoeuvre warfare and large-scale operations with armour. So at the moment we see Warrior is deployed, a Warrior battle group is deployed in Estonia. It shows the importance of Warrior as a platform, as well as Challenger 2 as a platform as well. So what you wouldn't want to see is any significant cuts to those brigades. We may see those come through if the government decides that it needs to cut platforms that it has in order to fund its strike brigades with the mechanised infantry vehicle coming through and also Ajax as well. So the tempting target is Warrior and Challenger, but I would say this would be a mistake to do.
That would also stand to reason that the Army Air Corps might be vulnerable as well, shifting some of that mission to RAF, but it also raises operational questions, especially if you're thinking about a conventional type scenario in Northern Europe, for example, to not have that.
Yes, the Army Air Corps is very vulnerable. In fact, the previous Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, when he was in front of the Select Committee last month, was talking about reducing duplication within the force. And the Army Air Corps is a great example of where there is essentially duplication. The RAF provides a helicopter force. It already provides air transport through Chinook aircraft and Merlin. So there is the argument that you don't need as many helicopters in the force, apart from Apache, which provides the attack helicopter elements of the Army Air Corps. And in order to reduce the support, helicopters cost money to support a lot more than ground vehicles, for example. So it is a very tempting target for the Army to say, we don't need the Army Air Corps as much. The risk of that operationally is that you lose that organic capability that the Army have had for a long time. The fact that soldiers progress through and can go to the Army Air Corps on attachment means that they have a greater familiarity with what the Army is doing. But the buzzword over the last decade has been joint, and there has been an idea for a long time that the Army and the Air Force will work together in a joint helicopter force, and I think that really was the death knell for the Army Air Corps. So I think we are going to see some significant cuts to the helicopter force.
And finally, the Royal Air Force has been extremely busy, but also relevant with its Typhoons and Tornadoes, Operation Shader, also its Reapers. It's on the cusp of getting F-35Bs and potentially modified Typhoon. Where do they stand to fare when you look at the cuts that potentially could impact that service because of its high operational tempo?
Well, I think the RAF is due to fare relatively well compared to the other services. And I think it's had the opportunity to demonstrate just how important air power is. It was one of the main contributions the UK could make to the war against Islamic State. And providing that air power, as limited as it was in terms of numbers, it still played a very important role, and it allowed the UK to showcase both the platforms and the weapon systems that they're deploying. So the UK is going to be very reluctant to reduce its capability any further. They've also got the threat from Russia and the air incursions that come through airspace, so the need to scramble aircraft, both from the UK and then also contributing to the NATO force in Europe. So it's highly unlikely that you'll see cuts to frontline aircraft numbers. What we could see is reduction to elements such as training, maintenance and readiness. These are very seen as low-hanging fruit if you're trying to make efficiency savings. So the risk is that you will see fleets cannibalised in order to make saving costs there. The RAF will be loath to do this. They almost came unstuck doing this with the Tornado force when they tried to mount Op Shader. There was very low availability with the Tornado squad that were based at RAF Akrotiri. So again, this would be a very risky strategy to go through, but it would make savings that otherwise you would have to find through cutting frontline aircraft numbers.
Could the Tornado fleet disappear faster than expected?
Yes, with Op Shader now winding down, it was already due to come out of service, with one squadron being withdrawn next year in 2018 and the following two squadrons in 2019. So what we could see is an acceleration of that withdrawal. But the risk there is that the Typhoon upgrade and the ability to launch the weapon systems that Tornado currently can, if that is delayed and if that isn't completed until the end of 2018, they may then have a situation where you don't have enough aircraft that can deploy weapon systems such as Storm Shadow, the long-range air launch cruise missile that the UK have, or even Brimstone, which has proven a really effective capability in the war against Islamic State.
Well, thank you, Ben. It was great to speak with you here in Avasense London office. To listen to more of the On the Record podcast, you can find us on iTunes or at avasense.com.